Blog Talk Radio.
12 Angry Men, Long Day's Journey Into Night, The Pawnbroker, Failsafe, The Hill, The Seagull, The Anderson Tapes, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, The Wiz, Prince of the City, Death Trap, The Verdict, Daniel, The Morning After, Running on Empty, Q&A, Night Falls on Manhattan, Critical Care, Find Me Guilty, and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Over the course of 50 years and almost as many films, he has delivered some of cinema's great treasures, a wealth of breathtaking performances, and some of its most iconic moments.
Erica!
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 Movies don't get any more powerful, more human, or more honest. Tonight, a two-hour tribute to one of our cinematic legends, Mr. Sidney Lumet. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
I'm as mad as hell, but I'm not going to take this anymore!
Geeks United, it's tribute time. Tonight we're paying tribute to one of our great filmmakers, Sidney Lumet, and we couldn't be more excited to bring this to you tonight. My name is Jamie, and my co-host Jerry is with me here. Hey, guy.
Hey, what is up? How's everyone doing?
Exciting show tonight.
You couldn't get bigger. This is big.
Yeah, this yeah.
Very big. We've been talking about a career.
Yeah, this is a major film career, probably the most... the longevity this artist has enjoyed is unprecedented. A couple of notes before we get started. You can always join fellow movie geek fans in our chat room and discuss Lumet films or anything you want, really, in our chat room. Just click on the chat available icon in the upper right hand of the screen, I think it's located. If you have any questions for us or for our guests, you can always submit them through our chat room or call in live. Our number is 718-508-9477. I just must put a disclaimer up at the top here that we only have one live interview tonight, and that's with actor Colm Feore. He will close the show at the last half hour, and all the other interviews have been pre-recorded. But we do have a great lineup, including Chris Sarandon, co-star of Dog Day Afternoon, an amazing story. How he got involved in that film and what that ended up becoming for him. We have author Joanna Ratz, who wrote Sidney Lumet Interviews, a really enlightening book. She edited the book, and it's a culmination of 20 different interviews with Lumet. We also have little insights into Lumet from another one of our favorite guests, author Richard Pepperman, and screenwriter Kelly Masterson, who wrote Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And then, of course, we welcome Colm Feore, a terrific character actor, who's been in Critical Care and Night Falls in Manhattan for Mr. Lumet, as well as Face Off and tons and tons of
he's
films.
He's been in everything.
He's in the new season of 24. He plays one of the lead characters in that. He plays one of the leads in the new Clint Eastwood movie that just got raves over at Cannes Film Festival.
Right,
so
right.
Very highly accomplished actor. We can't wait to welcome him on later on the show. I like doing these tribute shows because the last one we did was Indiana Jones, and then before that we did Paul Schrader, and especially with a Schrader tribute show, it seemed to really spark people's interest in revisiting some of these older films of his.
Right.
Yeah, and I know you did, Jerry, too, received many emails and testimonies to the fact that, you know, they went back and they rented Hardcore and watched it because we gave so much time to it on the show.
That's right.
It is impossible to review a 50-year career and be completely comprehensive.
No way possible.
No way possible. So, but we're going to try to scratch the surface tonight and reconnect you with some of these films you might have forgotten about over the years, or introduce you to them for the first time. That would be wonderful.
That would be.
When I mention Sidney Lumet, Jerry, what comes to your mind?
I think of disillusionment. I think of an individual who is taken for granted to do the right thing all their life, but the system, they're beaten by the system, a very corrupt system. They play by the rules, but they realize that's not how you get by. Take, for example, Serpico, Prince of the City, and if you really want to go for the two, like almost bookends, Network and Critical Care, where there's
right.
so much disillusionment within the individuals, not just the main characters, but everyone. It doesn't know what to do. Everyone's just like ready to throw up their arms. But the disillusionment within the system is like the first thing that comes to mind for a majority of his work.
That's a very strong theme. I think he's described it as how good, decent people, go through a corrupt system.
Mm-hmm.
How they can possibly do that unscathed. And you see that, and the systems change. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is law enforcement. You know, you think Serpico.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have the law with the verdict. You have television with Network.
Mm-hmm.
You have the medical care industry, the healthcare industry with critical care. All these different environments, and his movies are political without being political, because they're not about issues, they're about the people
mm-hmm.
that exist within these issues,
Yeah, he doesn't he doesn't preach in that regard. He doesn't pick a side of the aisle. He's not partisan in that regard at all. He really, they are very political, but he keeps, ironically, the politics out of it.
The first thing that strikes me about Lumet films, the acting. That's the first thing that strikes
mm-hmm. me. Yes.
There's not a bad performance in any of his films. And the second thing is the writing. And, I mean, these are two very obviously crucial aspects of his work, and it's all because of the theater. Sidney Lumet came from the theater as an actor.
Right.
That's how he started. So he has tremendous empathy for the actor. He knows what makes the actor shine. He knows what to do, how to work with each personality.
Mm-hmm.
He's mastered
right.
that art. And he also, coming from the theater, loves the writer's work. That's why you'll see him do Eugene O'Neill. You'll
mm-hmm.
see him do Tennessee Williams, David Mamet. He's not afraid of, he doesn't look at a script and see two pages of monologue and think, oh, God, that's theater. This can't be cinema. No. He relishes that. And all of his movies, even the ones that are based on plays and shot on stage.
Some of the best ones, actually.
Long Day's Journey Into Night. Cinematic. They're not real. Yeah. They're pretty amazing.
He's incredible. He's very incredible that way, in every way. And it's just, it's amazing. Like we had said a while ago, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the film that he came out with last year.
Yeah.
That's, seems like it could be a film that would be made by a younger person, and he's still as sharp as ever. He doesn't
it
miss
really
a beat
is.
In that film.
And also, it drives something else home to me, particularly about The Devil Knows You're Dead. It's indicative of a lot of his films, is that he refuses to sentimentalize the characters. Just because you're... and he's been revolutionary in bringing about different groups of people onto films for the first time. He made the first real mainstream movie about a homosexual with Dog Day Afternoon.
That's right.
Cast Pacino, the biggest star at the time. To play the lead part. The Pawnbroker, Jewish and African-American characters in that film that occupy that film.
Mm-hmm.
He refuses to make them angelic, though.
No one is angelic in these films.
Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of times you would see that there would be a fear of they have to have this bright, shining glow over them or else they're... But he and even Network... with this portrayal of Faye Dunaway
in mm-hmm.
Network, a woman in power. And around that time, that was a very sensitive kind of topic where women
right.
were starting to come into their own, he wasn't afraid to make her completely and totally non-sympathetic.
No, I would say anything but.
No, and it really speaks to his approach. He is no sentimentality. He wants it to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and it is.
And in interviews, he said, "I don't really judge good or bad. Whether my movies are great or good, are they honest? I mean, do they work for me at an honest level?"
Right.
And this is a guy that likes naturalism, likes realism, likes honesty in his films. And as a result, as you'll hear later on in this interview we're about to play, that's part of the reason why he's embraced the new digital technology in a way, because it's even more natural than film can get it for you. I mean, he shot Before the Devil Knows You're Dead on digital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and his argument is, I can do everything you can do on film, on digital, just better.
Right, you know? Absolutely.
And it's amazing, and the man's innovation. 83 years old, he's been in the business over 50 years, and he's just latching on to the new invention with this digital technology.
That's right.
You know, you picture somebody like grasping their last breath onto their film camera, because that's the school they come from. But he's completely new school. He's completely vibrant and innovative each time out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're gonna open up the show. We're gonna play our interview with Joanna Rapp. She is the editor of Sidney Lumet Interviews, a series of interviews with Lumet since 1960. Actually, the first interview in the book is between Lumet and Peter Bogdanovich. It's a fascinating book. It's available now. And let's hear this interview right now, and then we'll come right back to you. Joanna Rapp is with us tonight. She's authored several exceptional books on the art of filmmaking, including Buster Keaton, a bio-bibliography, On the Waterfront, and Sidney Lumet Interviews, in which she serves up a series of spectacular and insightful conversations dating back to a 1960 exchange between Lumet and Peter Bogdanovich. Dr. Rapp has also published an enormous body of work in some of our most distinguished film journals, including Film Quarterly, Film Criticism, and the Journal of Popular Culture. Poetry, which is her other passion, has inspired another series of breathtaking works and critical collections. She currently teaches graduate courses in film theory and criticism with an emphasis on feminine theory and comic theory at the University of Oklahoma. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Joanna E. Rapp to Movie Geeks United. Joanna, are you with us?
I am with you, Jamie. That's a bit of a breathtaking introduction.
I like to sell my guests. I like to make them feel welcome. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show, and I've read the book, the Sidney Lumet interview book, and it's so enlightening. It's a real treat and a gift to any fan of Lumet. What was it about Lumet specifically that drew you to his work?
It was his book, Making Movies.
Really?
As with so many other people, you know, I teach introductory film courses, and most of the introductory film texts that one uses in these courses are incredibly boring. very expensive. And I came across Lumet's little book, Making Movies, and it did everything I wanted to do in an introductory film course in a third of the length, and it was engagingly written. And so I started using his book in my classes. And of course, in conjunction with the book, I started showing his movies.
Right.
So that's how it happened.
So what about his book did everything that you set out to do in your teachings?
How to make a film from script to screen, which is what I do in my introductory classes, which is takes students through the filmmaking process so that by the time they're done, they know what's involved in making a film.
Right.
And Lumet's book does that brilliantly.
Are there particular films that you, obviously you said that you show films to them as well as kind of a companion to the book. What films do you teach of Lumet's?
I mean, over the years, because I've been doing this for years, I haven't taught all of them, but I've taught an awful lot of them. Ones that I consistently use are, of course, 12 Angry Men, primarily for cinematography. I also use The Hill for cinematography.
That's a good one. I love that one.
Oh, so underrated. So good. For set design, I'll use something like Murder on the Orient Express. For acting, very often I use The Verdict because Paul Newman's performance in that is so good. I have of course used Long Day's Journey and Tonight both for cinematography and for acting, but the film is long and it makes it difficult to use in a class, unfortunately.
Right.
But I know he considers that one of his very best films, and it really is stunning. Screenplay. Oh, I've used Critical Care.
I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
Stephen Schwartz, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Network would be Patty Chayefsky.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Yep, I have used Network, and I've also used Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh yeah.
Which is so interesting. it did win the Academy Award for screenplay, and so much of it was ad-libbed. And Lumet discusses that in his book, where he says it's all about the structure. So Dog Day Afternoon does work well too.
So tell me, let's start with something like The Verdict. What, in terms of performance, what do you focus on in Paul Newman's performance? What is the structure of what you teach about performance using that film?
Well, I talk, about the little things that he has Newman do. The process of gradual enlightenment, which in fact may be a little bit more to do with the cinematography than Newman's performance. But it's the little gestures that Newman does all the way through there, putting the eye drops in his eyes. The gradual build up out of depression to his final summation in that film, where Lumet can just hold on him as he speaks, which is so beautiful.
It really is, and it's a no-frills performance, but it's also, in reading what Lumet has to say about it in some of these interviews, it's absolutely, for him, a movie about salvation. Yeah, and I'm curious about some of these themes that occur time and time again in his work. Some of his best movies and most beloved movies are about how people kind of navigate their way through corrupt systems, whether it be law, police. There's been so many. Night Falls in Manhattan to Serpico.
Yeah.
Do you see other kind of common threads in his work thematically?
Well, that's a really big one. I've written about that in some other places too, which has to do with the theme of justice, and the very gray area there is between the law and human decency and caring. But that's such a common. It really is a thread that runs all the way through his film. About emerging as a human being in a very corrupt world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It also struck me too. There was another kind of thread that he shed light on in your book here, between Daniel running on empty and family business, which he admits a family business. Yeah, about trying to overcome obstacles that kind of your elders set for you. I mean, isn't that what he had to say about those three films?
Yeah, in fact, he said it about Daniel and Running on Empty in his own book, and in the interview with me, he added family business to it, which is how children have to deal with the, I don't want to say sins of their parents, he put it better than I am right now, I can't remember his wording, but dealing with the legacy of your parents, and how that transforms you, and it It's very much, you know, a theme of those three films.
Also, I would add that's the theme really of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, almost sort of a footnote, but almost it's not so much dealing with your family, but stealing and tarnishing the family legacy that he addresses in that one.
Yeah, in fact, as you look back at all these films, the theme of family in a very broad sense is there
mm-hmm.
in film after film after film. I mean, it's in the, the Vin Diesel film, Finding Guilty.
It is in that, very strongly,
that's
right.
Very much about family. And, of course, mm-hmm. Gloria is all about family.
Mm-hmm.
A Night Falls in Manhattan is about family.
Q&A is about family as well.
Very, it certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
He really does has pretty consistently dealt with family in very interesting ways. I guess less so in his first film, 12 Angry Men.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there afterwards. Garbo Talks, which is a film he doesn't like particularly, but I love.
I love the end of that.
But it is interesting looking back at 12 Angry Men. I know we're jumping around here because we just love his work so much that we just go from one to the other. But
I'm glad you're doing this show.
It really is indicative of where he came from, because he started as an actor on the stage, and so it makes sense that he has that kind of empathy with the actors. Plight and his extensive theater work, and that kind of all came to fruition there in that first film he did, 12 Angry Men. Incredible.
And how do you see that, the fruition of his theater work there?
Well, because it's an ensemble. It's tightly confined, and yet it's very dramatic and cinematic, without being overly stylistic, which is something that I know that he abhors, in any sense of high style.
That's right. The decorator's touch. He hates it.
That's right. Tell me a little bit about that, because it shouldn't be surprising by watching his work, but he seems very cognizant about avoiding sentimentality at all costs. And I know he talks about this a lot in reference to Running on Empty in his conversation the two of you had.
Right.
What is his definition
also
of sentimentality?
Also in The Pawnbroker, which he finds, overly histrionic and a little sentimental.
Mm, right. Mm.
What is his definition of sentimentality?
As you understood it.
He'd have to speak for himself. I think it's stating, putting emotion out there too overtly. He likes things to be subtle. He talks about the, it's an example, I think it's in his book, and it's also in my interview, where he, in Prince of the City, as the main character, like the Newman character in The Verdict, moving towards redemption, and he starts wearing a cross, but nothing is ever said about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he made a speech about, I'm starting to find God again, that would be sentimental.
Right.
On the nose,
Just having him wear a cross and not saying anything and leaving it up to us to pick it up, that's avoiding sentimentality.
Right.
And I can see why there are aspects of Running Out Empty he might find sentimental. It does have that overt speech at the end of it where the father says to the River Phoenix character, go out there and make a difference, son. We tried.
Right.
That, you know what it is, actually. You know how he hates rubber ducky explanations.
It's almost like it's almost like speaking the subtext.
Exactly.
In a way. It's a little too on the nose for him, yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I would think it would be such a difficult trap to avoid, especially when you're dealing with themes of family. Just thinking about my thoughts about my own family, it's impossible not to get sentimental about those kinds of themes and those
mm-hmm.
kinds of stories.
But he's pretty successful in avoiding it.
Yeah,
he really is. You know, even in a film like Garbo Talks, which he thinks is too sentimental.
I think it has to do with, I know he says in one of these interviews in your book that he doesn't grade his work on is it great or is it good or bad. He just concerns himself with whether or not it is honest.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So looking at his work, what are some of the highlights for you? Whether it be entire films or specific scenes, what are you particularly taken by?
You know, this gets personal because it's those aspects of his work that really resonate with you personally. For me, Running on Empty does very much so, because in many ways I lived that film, and that father's speech at the end to River Phoenix really resonates with me, and the final shot, which you know Lumet describes as a visual hug, where the car drives around the boy twice.
Yeah.
Oh, that blows me away. You know, I lose it.
I hear you.
And visually, what did he do in that work? I don't know if I have it the opposite way around, where he started out with a very flat television image, and
no,
that got more and more.
It's the other way around.
He started out with naturalism
in the lighting, and as the film evolved, it became. Gradually became lit more and more like a TV commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is really hard to see, but he says he does that so that you know, at the last scene, the scene where, you know, they plot the murder of
Howard Beale.
Yeah. He said it's lit like a TV commercial, and there it looks very flat. You know, compared to the opening bar scene between the Holden character and what's his name?
Peter Finch's
character.
Howard Beale.
Yeah. Nothing lit like that at the end of the film.
It's just amazing to go back through these films, and he has such a resume. I think it's something like, is it 50 films, or close to 50 films now?
I think it's close to 50 films, I think.
Yeah, it must be 46, 47 now.
Yeah, and just an amazing body of work, one after another. Tell me, I know that you kind of idolized him in a way before meeting him.
Yeah.
Tell me what that experience was like, finally getting to sit down and talk to him one-on-one.
Well, I put that in the book a bit.
Yeah.
It was kind of unusual to put in a sort of professional scholarly book. You know, it was one of the memorable experiences of my life because I think, as my son said to Lumet, you're her god. In terms of filmmaking, in terms of his unbelievable knowledge of film, he's my god. And in terms of my teaching, he's my god. So when I walked into his office, you know, which is, and there he was, you know, all by himself. You know, no secretary, no nothing, just a plain building in a little office. And Sidney Lumet was sitting there at his desk.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, and then he's, you know, he's so human.
He's one of us.
He's
a real guy. It was wonderful. We brought him up here to Dartmouth in 2005 to give him.
Oh, wow.
Dartmouth gives a film award, you know, every year or so to really outstanding film person. And we brought him up here, and it was just after he got his Academy Award to honor him. That was thrilling to have him here. And he came to my class. Finally, he came to my class. he came with his friend Walter Bernstein, who's a Dartmouth graduate, who's written a couple of films with him. You know, having them, two of them here was very special.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, he went to production class and he talked to the kids about making movies.
What makes him still so vital and so relevant? Because if you look back on people of his filmmakers of his generation, I think there comes a time in most of their careers when they just stop. I don't know if they have nothing else to say or they feel like they're no longer relevant. But you know, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is as alive as any film he's ever made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you kind of attribute that longevity to?
Good health. that helps a lot.
Yeah.
And an intense passion for filmmaking and a real curiosity about human
yeah.
beings. And I think he would attribute part of it to living in New York. You work out on the coast and it kills you. But living in New York is a constant challenge and stimulation every
mm-hmm.
day. Being endlessly excited and curious about people in life and growing, you know, I mean, he's evolved his, you know, he really is a technician. And the fact that, you know, this new technology comes along, the HD video and shooting and digital, has just really excited him. And so the chance to work with new technology is thrilling. And
which I think is wonderful because you would think, as someone who's been in the business as long as he has, that he kind of bemoaned the impending death of film. But you're right, he's very excited about this HD technology. Then he
yeah.
used it on his television show, didn't he?
Pardon?
He used it on his TV show, yeah.
Yeah, 100
yeah.
Center Street.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time he used it, and he just fell in love with it. And, you know, I think he works with Ron Fortunato, who's his cinematographer now. He's a real pioneer in what you can do with HD video.
Yeah.
And so that excites him.
Yeah, it's amazing, and that I cannot thank you enough for joining us today, and
yes,
also
you.
for your dedication to teaching his work, because we're bombarded with films that you know, there's a cut every second, and they're all made for short attention spans, and for you to be out there with Lumet's work that takes patience and intelligence, and you know, I commend that completely.
Yes.
Well, that's Lumet for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
he teaches you how to watch movies. Which
yeah.
is what we do in the classroom too.
Yeah.
So, well, I thank you guys for doing this show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, and
very
we will.
Thank you. Very
bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Joanna Rapp. The book is called Sidney Lumet Interviews. A really kind of enlightening conversation. She brought up a couple of amazing titles. But first of all, let's talk about something else that she started off with, which is his book, Jerry. It's a very
good book. I have it right here in my hand.
Making Movies. That came out. It came out of the mid to late 90s or
96? I want to say the mid 90s. Give me a second and I'll get the exact date. I think 95 is the... Yeah, 95.
It's a real, and Lumet doesn't consider himself a writer, but he's very proud of the book. I've heard him say in interviews where he's gone back and reread it and said, hey, I did a good job with this book. And it really is a textbook for people that want to know the practicality of making films, what's involved in it.
And if I'm not mistaken, the director we had on last week read this book. Brian
that's right.
Martino. Remember, he mentioned this specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, he directed The Strangers, and he said, I knew nothing about directing when they hired me to do this, so the first thing I did was read Lumet's book.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about
so ironic. Yeah, it was terrific. And so that is a real textbook, and it's available now in stores, and actually we have the icon on our page there. To click on that, it'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase the book yourself. It's a wonderful book, and to learn directing from a master, you can't get any better than that.
You really can't.
She brought up two of my favorite Lumet films, so let's talk a little bit about them now. The Verdict and Running on Empty. Let's start by playing a little clip from The Verdict real quick
okay.
to give you a sense. This is 1982, Paul Newman, James Mason, a dynamite cast,
mm-hmm.
Jack Warden,
really about a lawyer that's he's an alcoholic. He's kind of ravaged. He's used to being kind of a loser.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And he really gets a second wind when this case comes to pass, where you know, he finally decides to take a stand one last time because he feels like he can win this case, and it's more about his salvation as well. There's a lot on the line with this film, and it's a terrific film, one of the last just beautiful, perfect Newman performances. Here's the trailer to that film.
His name is Frank Galvin. 4 cases in the last 3 years. He's lost them all. He drinks. This man's scared to death to go to court.
Frankie, listen to me, because I'm done with you. I got you a good case. It's a moneymaker.
The Archdiocese called up because the case is coming to trial.
This is our chance to get away.
I'm going to see that you get that chance. Court exists to give them a chance at justice.
And is that what you're going to do?
Maybe I can do something right.
I just heard someone offer you $200,000.
When I walk out that door, the offer is withdrawn.
What are you, nuts?
I can win it. I can win this case.
What are you going to do?
I need your help.
To do what?
They killed her. I'm trying to buy it.
I said, do you know what you did?
No, Jeez, take it easy.
Okay. And I got to find out from the other side that they offered $200,000.
I can subpoena you, you know.
Well, maybe you just better do that then.
I had a witness disappear on me. Gar, you should have taken their offer. I have no sympathy for you. Pushing into court 5 days early. I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide.
All right.
Hear ye, all persons having anything to do before the Honorable, the Justices of the Superior Court, now sitting at Boston, within and for the County of Suffolk, draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard.
It's a fantastic movie. That's one of my favorite Lumets. It's right up there. And talk about a great cast, man. James.
That
Mason,
is. It's a wonderful cast. It's a great film.
Charlotte Rampling. Another no sentimental scene. Paul Newman figures out that Charlotte Rampling's working for the other side, and she's been kind of romancing him, and on his side all along. She's kind of like a double agent. The scene where he finds that out and confronts her, and they stare at each other for the longest time, and she knows that he knows. Mm-hmm. And right when you're wondering, you know, what's he going to say, he hauls off and punches her and then leaves the restaurant. that's a great scene.
That is.
That's a great, that's Lumet through and through. That's just incredible. But another actor who, Paul Newman, who's been in the business forever as well, benefited enormously from Lumet's direction.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, I mean, the great actors love to be directed, you know, and it's like discovering Paul Newman for the first time in this film.
Very true. What did he do after the did he do Fort Apache after this, or was that before?
I think possibly around the same time.
I know the
time.
Color of Money is a couple of years later.
Yeah, yeah. It really brought about some kind of a resurgence, I would imagine, for him.
It did.
Even though he'd never been gone, really.
He was never gone, but he went through this phase, I guess, later on, where every movie that he did was going to be his last movie, but every couple of years it kept coming back.
I think it revitalized him, too. He recognizes it as one of his very best performances as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really stoked his fire to, you know, get back in there if he would had been away for any length of time. I don't really know, but this is a clear example of why I love Lumet. It's hard for me to put it into words, but we interviewed an author of a book called The Film School: Everything I Need to Learn About Filmmaking I Learned from Watching DVDs. It's his book. It's a great book. One of the 50 titles that he studies in that book, and he illuminates certain lessons in his book with each scene that he discusses, is from The Verdict. It's the scene where our lead character has a change of consciousness, and he decides to take a stand, take this case to trial, and finally try to believe in himself again and believe in the system again. Now, there's many ways to do this. You can hit it on the head. You can do it two on the nose. But Lumet refuses to play that way. And nothing is on the nose with Lumet. He is a pure director. And this is this description that Mr. Pepperman gives here, it's as clear put as I can think to describe what I'm talking about, his style of direction, how he brings out the most of each scene from an honest point of view. Here's a clip from our conversation with him. I was especially taken by your analysis of some key moments in Lumet's film, The Verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a character transition section that I believe when the lead character visits the hospital room, and what was the lesson to be learned from that particular scene?
Well, one of the interesting things to me about The Verdict is that just about the time Ed Dimitrik's book on film editing was released, David Mamet's book on directing film was released, and David Mamet had written the screenplay for The Verdict. It's an adaptation. And on the last page of Dimitrik's book, he happily reports this one particular scene. It's a different scene than you're addressing, but I think it's worth mentioning this as well. Dimitrik thought that perhaps film had suddenly broken free from 20 or 30 years of a journey to imitate theater and was returning to its roots of the European montage approach. And so I thought it interesting. In his last chapter, he talks about Eisenstein and other Russian theorists and then mentions Sidney Lumet's film, The Verdict. And in Mamet's book, he addresses his understanding of film as being nothing more than Eisenstein's notions of telling a story through a cut. Mm-hmm. But in The Verdict, there is a scene which I would suspect would have probably voice over if done today, in which an attorney would reveal to the audience his sudden catharsis.
Right.
And that he realizes that this case matters not only to the family, but is his redemption. But in the film, this drunken ambulance-chasing and worse attorney visits a rather run-down hospital where his client is on a respirator in a vegetative state. There's a beautiful use of both the respirator breathing apparatus along with a Polaroid camera he takes out. And his plan initially is he's going to take some horrifying pictures of this poor woman in a fetal position on a respirator, take it to the archdiocese office because all of this happened at a Catholic hospital in Boston. And then he'll convince them to give him a decent amount of money. He'll take a third. It'll never go to trial. He doesn't have to do any work and just goes on about his life. But in this scene, he takes out the Polaroid camera and the respirator noise and the kind of the Polaroid camera's ejecting the print makes a very similar whooshing kind of sound. And he puts the pictures down. He takes two of them. And then he stares at his camera, of course, both as metaphor that he now sees something that he hadn't seen before. But it's not on a conscious level until you watch the scene some half dozen or more times. And then he just sits on an empty bed next to his client's bed and just stares. And Lumet actually has the two Polaroid pictures come to life and holds more than 30 seconds as the last developing part of that process in Polaroid stills comes about.
Yeah.
And we see his patient on this respirator. And we, of all things, we hear giggling. And it's two nurses on their way either back from lunch or on their way to a break. And one of them looks in and sees Paul Newman, who plays the attorney, Frank Galvin, sitting on the bed and says, sir, you're not to be in here. And he doesn't answer. And she walks towards him and says, I said, you're not to be in here. And there's this long 5, 6, 8 second pause. And he never even looks at the nurse. He just says, I'm her attorney.
Yeah.
He doesn't use lawyer in the phrase. And we just get it. And this is a powerful transition within the story and the character.
And it's an example of just a beautiful piece of directing,
mm-hmm.
where it's just a terrific filmmaker he is, where it's not on the nose. You know, it's a use of everything in your environment, the props, everything else, and you're right. It probably would include voiceover now, so that the audience would feel safe to know that this is exactly what's happening now. But the bravery of that it transmits the idea that his consciousness becomes clear as those Polaroids start to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Just that notion, it's beautiful filmmaking. Yeah, that's probably my favorite scene in The Verdict. And it's the one scene that I always used to describe why I like Lumet as much as I do. You know, I mean, Jerry, it's hard to describe what directing is.
It really is. It is, but I want to add something to that, though.
Yeah.
He's right. You would, unfortunately, today need voiceover, and it wouldn't be anywhere near as effective.
No.
I mean, it just wouldn't work really that well at all. But he's absolutely right, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, but he uses everything in his means, everything within reach. How can I use these elements to bring about the most drama in this scene?
Right. And he does it all the time.
That's a great example, that scene mm-hmm. right there in The Verdict. And you're right, he does it time and time again. He says that he's not a stylish director, and that's true. He doesn't call attention to himself.
Right.
But his direction brings out the most of what that piece of material has to offer.
And let's talk about that if we have time, his direction, especially as you said with actors. Because in
yes.
almost every film, there are several incredible performances, but I think the thing that has to be taken into account is he's one of the first directors to take Sean Connery and say, I think you can do more than James Bond.
Yeah.
And he did it more than three times. But
tell us about those titles.
The Hill, which is a kind of British military prison, and that has the late Ian Bannon in it. The Offense, which I have never seen, which I think has just become available on DVD. The Anderson Tapes, which I think everyone has seen, and then later on Family Business. But he does that, but then also this Christopher Reeve in Death Trap.
Yep.
He says, I think you can do more than Superman. And you see, and then if you really want to take it to the limit, it's Vin Diesel in Find Me Guilty. I think
That's better than what the society believes
you're capable of doing, kind of director. Yeah. He's willing to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Well, he recognizes it, and Vin Diesel is fantastic in Find Me Guilty. And I think we were like a lot of people. We saw Lumet, Find Me Guilty, a mob, courtroom story, Vin Diesel in the lead. And
mm-hmm.
we're thinking, what?
This guy was in The Pacifier and the Chronicles of Riddick before, and you don't really associate him with that, but look, he did it for him. I think that's probably his strongest performance.
It really is, but it also goes to show that you don't know how good someone is. It's all about the opportunities that they're given.
Yes.
I mean, back when Tom Hanks was doing The Man with One Red Shoe and that kind of thing, we all liked him. You know, Volunteers,
yeah.
He was a likable guy. Did we see him as a 2-time Oscar winner? No.
Yeah, I agree with that. The other actor, and you may disagree with me here, but I think it's important, is that he's really responsible, Lumet, for giving Pacino the back-to-back, you know, iconic roles of the 70s, because for a generation that only knows him as Tony Montana,
yeah,
or for the generation that knew him as Michael Corleone, maybe thought he couldn't do anything, here he does these two performances, two very different performances,
yeah,
and he cements himself as one of the, greatest actors of the second half of the 20th century.
I do have something to say about Pacino and his work with Lumet. Even in our conversation with David Edelstein the other day, he was criticizing Pacino, but at the same time he said Pacino is an actor that has to be directed. He has to have a good director, and Pacino will be the first one to tell you that.
Right.
And Lumet is one of the finest directors he's ever worked with, and the work that he brings out of Pacino in Dog Day, especially for me, is transcendent. And I've said this before, Dog Day Afternoon is this generation's On the Waterfront.
You're right.
Because, remember, people of that age, like Pacino and De Niro, they all came into acting because they were so inspired by Brando and On the Waterfront. People of our age and a little older went into acting because they saw Dog Day Afternoon.
Right.
You know, make no doubt about it. I, as much as I love Pacino, Dog Day is the one performance I cannot find a trace of him in. I forget I'm watching Pacino. Absolutely, 100%. I'm watching Sonny, his character in that film.
Because he had never done anything like that before.
No.
And I don't think he's done anything like it since. Unless I'm wrong, but I don't think anything like it since. Because unfortunately, and we all of us love Pacino on the show, but he does have this reputation in the later years as taking these sailing his reputation as a screamer. Which nothing could be farther
from
the
truth. But that's a whole different topic, and that's another half hour. That role is great, but it's the writing. I mean, the writing is coming. He's done awesome stuff throughout his career, but the caliber of writing with Dog Day, the type of character that is, it's a case of you don't know anything about this guy at the beginning of the movie.
Nothing.
You constantly find out new things about him. He's married. He and Sal are friends, and he's kind of a Vietnam vet. And Sal is a little overboard. You know, he's a little trigger happy, crazy.
Right.
Then you find out he's robbing the bank to pay for a sex change operation for his lover, and all of these things come to pass, and you find out so much more about him in the course of the movie, and then the movie ends. But you feel like there's still so much more to know about him.
Right.
That's another thing about Lou Metz films. There's no beginning and end. There's a life that took place before the movie happened, and there's a life that will continue on after it ends.
And I think that's the longevity of the films. That speaks to the longevity while we're talking about his films today.
Yeah, I agree. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. While we're talking about Dog Day, I mean, I guess that's the perfect...
Let's do it.
That's the perfect segue into our interview with Chris Sarandon. We have the pleasure of speaking to him over the weekend, and here is that interview, an amazing actor. Here you go. It is a great honor to welcome to the show a tremendous actor, Chris Sarandon, whose stunning feature film debut 33 years ago found him in the company of Sidney Lumet and Al Pacino. That film, of course, was Dog Day Afternoon, an astonishing work of art that is every bit as brave, honest, funny, and moving today as the day it premiered. Sarandon's work in that film earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor and features one of the most memorable scenes in the history of cinema. Lightning has struck several times for Mr. Sarandon throughout his career as he's portrayed characters as diverse as Jesus Christ, Abraham Lincoln, and Frankenstein. He's also been featured in timeless films which, much like Dog Day, will live on for generations to come, like Fright Night, Child's Play, The Princess Bride, and The Nightmare Before Christmas, for which he provided the indelible voice of Jack Skellington. Of course, all of this is just scratching the surface of his talent, as he is as equally prolific and accomplished on the small screen and the stage as he is in feature films. It is a great pleasure to welcome Chris Sarandon to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Sarandon, hello.
Hello. The thing that stood out most in that introduction was Dog Day Afternoon 33 years ago. Oh,
isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And it's such a time. I mean, you keep discovering new things about it every time you watch it. It keeps giving back to you. It's so timeless. So it's hard to imagine 33 years ago. And take me back to that time.
It is for me too. Believe me.
Take me back to this time because you had done a few things for television. I'm sure you'd done extensive stage work. How did this project come about for you?
It basically happened from an audition. I knew Sidney Lumet sort of socially from my ex-wife, Susan, who had worked with him on a movie, and I also knew Al Pacino socially because his, at the time, I guess, ex-girlfriend and I were in a show together, a Broadway show. So we all kind of knew each other, but my agent sent me up for it, so it wasn't as if it was a you know, Sydney didn't call me or Al didn't call me or anything. That was, it was really just a straight audition that my agent set up, and I went in. You know, we said hello and how you doing and everything, and then I sat down and read.
So were Lumet and Pacino there in the readings?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. You know, it's one of the great things about Al as an actor is that, you know, when they're, I mean, I don't know what it's like for him for most of his movies, but I assume it would be the same because he's such a conscientious team player. Is
yeah.
that he's always there because he wants to know, as does Sydney in this case. They want to know what the chemistry is like between the actors, and it was very important, particularly in this case, even though the two characters didn't appear on screen together.
Mm-hmm.
They had such a rich and bizarre history
yeah.
together that it was important to ascertain whether there was a chemistry between the actors.
What were your initial impressions upon reading it? Were you?
I mean, when I first read the script, I thought this. First of all, it's a great script,
yeah.
And in fact, it won an Academy Award for best screenplay that year for Frank Pearson, who wrote the screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
It was a story that had it was very unusual for the time. If you think back to that period in the 70s, when the whole gay rights movement really didn't exist, when AIDS was yet to come to the forefront as being one of the great healthcare
yeah.
tragedies of our time, when gay marriage didn't exist, you know, there was it was a real groundbreaking in many ways story, and not because it was about a gay relationship necessarily. It was about a human relationship gone sour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also a rather comic and ultimately tragic bank robbery gone sour.
Yeah.
So it was a very unusual piece, but at the same time, it was obvious from first reading that it was an extraordinary piece.
Well, you're right about that because I mean the movie is so many things. It's about so many things, but in terms of the portrayal of the gay relationship, I mean that really hadn't been explored in mainstream film before.
Right, never.
Yeah. So what's very groundbreaking in that?
Yeah.
In that?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Was this taken from actual events, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. There was a bank robbery in which the protagonist of the story, played by Al in this case, he was given a fictional name in the movie, but
right.
The real character went in and robbed a bank, and it was discovered through this rather bizarre media circus that occurred when the robbers were trapped in the bank with the employees of the bank that the bank robbery was initiated because the main character was trying to get money for a sex change operation for his boyfriend. And
yeah.
it became a major kind of media event in New York City. I don't know that it was necessarily a national one. I wasn't around. I mean, I wasn't in New York at the time. But I do remember it was a major media circus. It was covered very much as it's portrayed in the movie by all the major news outlets in New York. It was a big event mm-hmm. in the city.
Yeah. So did you have any kind of dialogue with your real life counterpart?
No, we all talked about that during rehearsals, whether we wanted to really access the real people or not. And the decision was made that, you know, it's close enough to real events. We had any number of articles that were written about the story. And in fact, now that I think of it, it was a national story because I know that there was a Life magazine article about the event. There were some photographs that we all used that were taken from the media at the time. We all used the material that was available to us, but we felt that getting in touch with and talking to the real characters was maybe just crossing a line that we didn't want to cross.
Yeah, but you did mention a rehearsal process, and I think this is what really makes Sidney Lumet special because
yeah.
he always allows
yeah, yeah.
for a rehearsal process. What is
yeah.
it? Tell me about that process and what that gave you.
Well, essentially what Sidney does, and he did at least in this picture, and I know he does it with his other movies, is he rehearses it very much like a play. you have, I believe we had approximately 3 weeks of rehearsal for Dog Day, and the set was laid out on the floor with a taped floor plan for each set. And I mean, obviously, the main set was the actual interior of the bank, and so you knew exactly what the spatial relationships that you were dealing with were, and you rehearsed it for, I mean, 3 weeks is a lot of time, mm-hmm. and you know, you work through scene by scene. In my case, the character is actually, just in terms of screen time, fairly minor. I mean, I think somebody told me once that the character's on screen for something like 11 minutes of the entire running of the movie. So I wasn't around every day, but the days that I was there, I can attest to the fact that the work that we did was very intense, very detailed. And in fact, the telephone scene, Al and I particularly felt, and I think Sidney concurred, that the scene itself was a wonderful scene in its outline, but that in its specifics, it was somewhat melodramatic and not really very true to life. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that Sidney is very open about is improvisation. While this was a brilliant script, and every bit of it was worthy of the Academy Award that Frank Pearson won, that there was, at least in our case, the telephone scene we felt needed some tweaking. And Sidney said, well, what do you think? And Al and I started talking, and we just started going into the scene in a kind of improvisatory way. But what we did was we incorporated all the information and the material that Frank Pearson had created for the scene, but just kind of reordered it and threw in a few things here and there. And after we finished, Sidney said, hold on. And he went and got somebody to come and transcribe to tape the scene as we had done it in the improvisation. So we did it again, and then we talked about what we had done, and Sidney said, well, you know, this is something that we need to leave in, or what about if we leave this out, or you could reorder this, and then we do it again. And we did, as I recall, a number of versions of the scene that were recorded, and then they sent them out to be transcribed, and then all of us got together, the producers, Marty Elfand and Marty Bregman and Sidney and Al and me, and I believe Frank was there too, and we just, you know, looked at all the versions of the scenes that we had done. I think we threw out a couple of them, and then we kind of, you know, got together and put together the scene.
Do you recall any of those moments that you found in that improv within that scene?
I think the allusion to I'm just trying to think. I mean, I'd have to sort of watch the scene. I mean,
yeah.
I could do an audio commentary for you. Oh yeah, that moment Al came up with in the improv. That was I just threw that in at one of them. I can't be very specific, but I do know that there were a number of things that we kind of threw in here and there, but you know, it was essentially Frank's scene, but
mm-hmm.
we it was kind of the variations on a theme by Frank Pearson, that scene.
So tell me, and obviously the rehearsal process was very valuable. I mean, just for that fact
alone.
Oh,
tremendously, yeah.
But there's a counter argument that it kind of it takes away from the sense of discovery or spontaneity when you're actually doing it on the set.
Much to the contrary, and I think when you talk to any theater actor, they'll tell you the same thing, and that is that, I mean, my theory, and this is just, you know, Chris Sarandon's cockamamie theory about movie acting, is that when you get into trouble is in the middle ground, when you've had some rehearsal, but you're not really solid, so that you don't feel like you can kind of fly, because you're not thinking about words, you're not thinking about situations, you're just thinking in the moment.
Right.
And the two extremes are no rehearsal when you're just really flying by the seat of your pants, and lots of rehearsal when you're so solid that you can fly by the seat of your pants.
Yes.
But you have the added dimension of feeling so secure with the material that you don't think about it, you don't worry about it. And
yeah.
To me, it's the middle ground that's the problem. When you've rehearsed a little bit and you're kind of okay, and you're not really flying by the seat of your pants because you're neither here nor there. So in my mind, going back to my comment I made about theater actors is that if you talk to people, and it's happened to me, who have done a run of a play for, say, 9 months or 6 months or whatever. Right. And, you know, I have people who have said to me, God, how can you do it night after night? But it's always changing because, particularly when you're working with good actors, those moments are always, you know, you look at somebody and something's different that night. Something mm-hmm. they bring to the performance that evening has changed it. And it literally does change from moment to moment. And so the spontaneity, I think, is not a problem. And for instance, you know, you look at Al Pacino, who is yeah. one of our great actors, and Al, you know, he likes to do 30 takes sometimes.
And
now,
he likes to
not
throw
in
you some curveballs,
movies, by the way. What?
He likes to throw you some curveballs in there, too, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, we all, you know, that's the fun of doing it, is that you're
yeah.
you're playing... I mean, and your metaphor of using the baseball parallel is very
yeah.
apt because, you know, a pitcher gets up there, he's got his repertoire, he knows he's going to throw a four-seam fastball or a two-seamer, he's where he wants to throw it, the catcher's prepared for it, but the human element enters in always, and the script is while the script is being followed, you know how you want to pitch to the batter. The ball doesn't always go exactly where you want it to, and
mm-hmm.
so you have to adapt to midair, literally, and that's, I think, a very apt metaphor for what goes on in acting.
Yeah,
performers.
Anyone that knows anything about me, Al Pacino is, he's quite a hero for me, and so I relish every opportunity I have to ask about him. Did you spend a lot of time with him, developing a relationship with him?
What happened was because we were not up right away with our scenes, that is, the scenes that Al was most of the time shooting, at least prior to the time that I actually did my scenes, we had a lot of time, and we didn't want to lose that sense of being solid in the scene that we had, and so he and I would get together whenever he had an opportunity, because I wasn't doing anything, he was the one who was working. And we'd get together, you know, I think maybe we got together two or three times from the time we rehearsed to the time we actually shot and just ran the scene. So, yeah, we did get together. I think I went over to his place a few times, and we just run it easily a few times, and then, hey, I'll see you in a few days, and then we'd get together again whenever we'd have the opportunity and run it again.
Mm. I know that we mentioned the rehearsal process. Another one of Lumet's strengths, I find that I've heard from others, is that it's probably the most important, is about creating an environment in which the actor can feel safe and can thrive.
Right.
How did he do that for you in this film?
Well, I think it's just the way Sidney works. Part of it is the fact that he allows you that rehearsal period to discover things and find things and to create a kind of actor-friendly atmosphere. It's always around. You know, he listens, he watches, he learns, and it's a constant sort of... But symbiotic process, you know, you're constantly trading information, talking, discovering, and also it's interesting too because one of the byproducts of this rehearsal process is that Sidney always finishes his movies on time and on budget, and sometimes
yeah.
under.
Yeah.
And it's not a function of his being in a rush, but of being prepared.
Mm.
And that's not only from the standpoint of Sidney knowing what he wants to shoot, how he wants to shoot it. He doesn't waste a lot of coverage. He knows how he wants to cover scenes going in. And so you have the sense that, you know, we're going to get this done. We've already done the work in the rehearsal room, and all we got to do is get out there and fly on the set.
Mm.
And so it's a very liberating kind of way of working.
When you're actually shooting this scene, and I want to get back to Mr. Lumet too, and what sets him apart as a director. But was Pacino actually on the other end of that phone? Were you actually playing?
Oh yeah, we both were. I would come in. I came in and did my end of the phone scene for Al when he was on camera, and he did his end of it on my on camera as well. Yeah, I mean that's, you know, that's something that's a given when you work with Sydney. You don't do off camera stuff where, you know, somebody takes a few hours off and somebody reads the lines off camera for the actor. You know, the actors are always there for each other. That's just the way he works, and the way most of the actors that he works with works. You know, nobody takes a time off when somebody else is on camera.
Absolutely. And I know I'm hiding it in my voice, but I'm absolutely giddy asking you about this scene, because it's honestly, it's one of the most astonishing scenes I've ever seen in an astonishing movie, just a Time Vault classic movie that means a lot to me. So, tell me more about Lumet, because this must have been something that your first time, it had to have spoiled you. You had to have thought that every movie would be.
Yeah, what do you do after that? Yeah, I've never, obviously not before, because it was my first feature, but never since have I had that kind of experience where, you know, I mean, I've had experiences where I've loved working with the actors, loved working with the director, but never one in which the preparation was so detailed and specific, and never one where the creative atmosphere was so rife and was so wonderful in terms of preparing one for going on the set and doing the movie. It does spoil you.
Yeah, but not only by working with him, but also by, you know, being a fan of his movies, which I'm sure you are, as all of us are.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is your take on what makes him one of the greatest directors?
Well, I think I've probably talked about most of them, and that is his receptivity, his preparedness, his ability to synthesize ideas and to create an atmosphere in which actors feel very much at home. Particularly, you know, he's a New York director. I think that's very clear about Sidney Lumet, and from New York, born, bred. As I recall, Sidney was an actor when he was younger in the Yiddish theater and in other venues, and so you, as an actor, feel very much that you're being taken care of, but not necessarily coddled, because he listens, he challenges, he wants to know what you think, but he's the ultimate authority. So it's not as if you have a feeling, well, I can just do whatever the hell I want, because Sidney will say, you know what, that doesn't really work. I mean, he does it in a very lovely and sweet and loving manner, but he makes his wishes very clear.
Are there other, outside of Dog Day, of course, are there other Lumet films that that you consider favorites or that you're particularly taken by?
Oh, gosh, where do I begin? certainly, Serpico is one of my favorites. I think Serpico is wonderful. I'd have to have a list in front of me, because I could probably name 10 of his movies.
There's 40 years of just in one after another.
Astonishing output, and not only in quality but also in quantity. He just keeps on keeping on. And I have seen him. I have seen him recently, and Sidney looks and sounds and is as vital and as completely in charge of his facilities as he was when I first met him.
Which is amazing, because you look at his last movie last year, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and you're absolutely right. It is every bit as vivid and vital as anything he's ever done.
Yeah.
Astonishing. I have to ask you before you leave, there's a few other films that you're particularly well known for, but isn't Fright Night, doesn't that have a big cult following?
Yeah, it's very interesting how, I mean, when I did that movie, this was in the 80s, I guess, mid-80s, I thought, well, you know, this is a great script and a terrific genre movie and something that I enjoyed. Actually, that was one of the only other movies in which the director had rehearsal. And one would think, well, geez, you know, a vampire movie? Why would he have rehearsals? But the director, whose name is Tom Holland, was very, very, had been an actor, and was very interested in plumbing the subtextual relationships of these characters. And I think it's one of the reasons why the movie has such a shelf life, is because it's not just a scary movie, but it's also a movie about people who are caught in a very unusual set of circumstances, and how they deal with it in a very human way. It was a great experience, and it's had a really remarkable shelf life. I have people who are constantly stopping me in the street saying it's one of their favorite all-time movies, people who are not necessarily genre movie, vampire movie, horror movie fans who love that movie.
Right, but the ones that are the horror movie junkies, they are quite invested in these films. They're a unique breed, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, it's extraordinary just how completely besotted and wrapped up they are in these pictures.
And I see that you're filming something right now that seems really exciting. Are you shooting the stage version of Cyrano for PBS?
That has already been done. Actually, they shot over two or three performances, I think it was, of the Broadway run. Cameras were in the audience at the time, and they shot it while we were doing the performance. And then they had a couple of extra little pickup filmings of close-ups and the sort of stuff that they couldn't do with an audience there. But that's already been done. I'm not sure when it's going to be shown, but it's going to be a PBS special.
Oh, I cannot wait. I cannot wait. What a dream,
in which
what
I
a
play
dream project
the,
that is.
The bad guy.
Yeah. And Kevin Kline as Cyrano. It's a dream cast.
Yeah. Kevin Kline, Jennifer Garner, Daniel Sinjata. It's a lovely group.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Sarandon, I cannot thank you enough for participating today. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to add my kind of limited and maybe not terribly informative, but heartfelt voice to this tribute to Sidney Lumet.
Oh, it's been wonderful to speak to you, sir. Thank you so much for your
time.
Sure
thing. My pleasure.
All right, bye-bye now. Thank you.
Bye.
It's our time with Chris Sarandon. This is an amazing story. First movie out of the gate, Dog Day Afternoon.
It's incredible. I mean, that's really just incredible.
You couldn't ask for a better opening for a career.
No, you can't.
Yeah, and it's one of the, I'm honest, honestly, and you know, it's not just me, it's known, it's one of the most astonishing scenes. Certainly from 70s cinema, if not from the cinema of the past
Even
30 years.
Even Pauline Kael likes that scene.
Yeah, and that's something. You know, it's interesting, too. We haven't mentioned, and I'm going to play that scene from Dog Day in a second, we haven't mentioned the way he works. Our guests have.
Right.
Chris Sarandon just spoke to it. He comes from theater, like we said. He comes from an actor's perspective, so he does rehearse all of his movies.
Right.
For 2 to 3 weeks. Which is amazing, which makes him a very efficient filmmaker, too, because I read time and time again all of these movies that he's done, almost always comes in under budget, under schedule.
Unheard of.
The man is prepared. The man is a saint. I mean,
that's
probably why he's been working on the studio projects for the past 50 years. Let's get real about it. But even so, there's the scene in Dog Day, and I don't think it's the one with Sarandon. I think it's the one with his wife, that takes place after the Sarandon conversation, where Pacino likes at least 8 takes of things, from what I've heard, and Lumet likes to do 1 or 2, and that's it. But he knows what an actor needs. So
right.
Pacino exhausted himself on take after take after take of the scene, and then Lumet said, okay, we're going to do it again. And he gave him this incredulous look. He wanted Pacino to be at that point beyond exhaustion for that conversation with his wife on the phone. And it's a beautiful moment. The movie is just so gorgeous to me. I mean, it's timeless.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Let's play that scene.
Let's do it.
From Dog Day, a little bit of that scene. Here it goes, between Sarandon and Pacino.
Don't you ever listen to yourself when you say that? You're dying.
Did you ever listen to yourself?
What are you talking
about?
What do you mean, what am I talking about? You're dying. Do you know that you say that to me every day of your life?
Oh. I'm dying.
Well, you're not dying. You're killing the people around you is what you're doing.
Oh, come on.
Leon, don't give me that shit. You know, I don't need that deep shit now.
Well, I don't think you realize what it means, Sonny. You know, the things you do.
Yeah? I know what I do.
You stick a gun to somebody's head.
Yeah, well, I don't know what I'm doing time with that.
Yeah, well, obviously you don't.
Go to sleep, Leon, so it won't hurt when I pull the trigger.
What do you think I've been doing in the hospital? I mean,
I take a handful of pills to get away from you, right?
Yeah.
So, and then now I'm talking to you on the phone again, right? I got no job. I don't have friends. I can't live. I have to live with people. This death business, I'm
sorry.
I don't know, Leon. You know, I don't know what I'm getting here with that shit. You know, what am I supposed to say to that shit? You know, this is going on,
and you're giving me that shit.
I'm sorry.
You know what's happening with me. You know that. You know the pressures I've been having, right? I mean, I got all these pressures, and you know about it. You're in that hospital there with all them tubes coming out. You want that fucking operation, right? You're giving me that shit. Everybody's giving me shit. Everybody needs money. You know what I mean? So, you need your money, I got your money. That's it.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't ask you to go and rob a bank.
No, I know you didn't ask me. I know you didn't ask me. Look, I want to, you know, I'm not putting this on anybody, you know? Nothing on nobody. I did this on my own, you see? All on my own I did it. But I just want you to know something. I want you to know that I'm getting out of here. I'm getting a plane out of here. And I just wanted you to know it, that's all. And I wanted you to come down. And I wanted to just say goodbye to you here. Or if you wanted to, you can come with me. I mean, you're free to do what you want. That's just what I wanted to say to you, that's all.
Yeah. I'm free to do what I want, huh?
Right.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to get away from you for 6 months, and I'm going to go with you on a plane trip, huh? Well, where are you going?
I don't know where yet. We said Algeria. I don't know. So I'll go to Algeria. I don't know then.
Why are you going to Algeria?
I don't know why. They got a Howard Johnson's there, so I'm going.
Howard, you know what I mean?
You're warped, you know that? You're really warped.
I'm warped. I know I'm warped.
God, Algeria, it's, you know, they walk around, they got masks on, they got things on their heads. There were a bunch of crazy people there.
So what am I supposed to do?
Well, I don't know. You could have picked a better place.
Like where? Sweden? Denmark?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
You know what? Say I wanted to go to Wyoming.
Oh, jeez.
I had to tell him it's not a country. He don't know where Wyoming is. See, I'm with a guy who don't know where Wyoming is. You think you've got problems?
Yeah. It's Dog Day Afternoon. It's a little snippet from what ends up being a 7 or 8 minute scene.
I love that you think you got problems. I love that.
And that's one of the big jokes of the movie, too. Yeah. You're trying to get out of the country. Is there any place you want to go? Wyoming.
I know.
that line gets people every time.
Yeah.
It's what an amazing movie and a career filled with them. Another amazing movie. I feel like we're playing clips, but I mean, the clips, you know, galore, but it's just too good. The stuff is too good.
Right.
Another classic movie is Network. Written by another outstanding writer, Paddy Chayefsky. This is one of those movies that is way ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And it predicted a lot of what we're seeing today.
Yes, we discussed
today. The media, you know, especially in this administration and stuff that we're in today, the media and how they kind of mold things, you know, they mold perception. And, it's amazing. Timeless work.
Yeah, and it's also Paddy Chayefsky also wrote another movie around the time, The Hospital, which was one of the best, at least when my dad was practicing medicine, said it was the most realistic portrayal of medicine in film that he had ever seen, and he was taking ER and St. Elsewhere into account. And I would have to say that Lamette's Critical Care is sort of his version of The Hospital, updated for the 90s.
Right.
And I think it's a very nice ode to Chayefsky's work and everything, Critical Care.
He's amazing. So amazing writer. And very, very like, poetic dialogue,
mm-hmm.
Very enhanced. And the whole feeling of the movie is very enhanced.
Right.
Joanna, earlier in the show, spoke to the style of the movie and how it develops and becomes more and more of a flat television look. It really is a biting satire and just a great deal of truthfulness. What it has in common with Dog Day, outside of thematics, it really, Sarandon, outside of the gate, he's in the movie maybe 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He gets an Oscar nomination. Beatrice Straight won the Oscar for Network. She's in the movie for about 6 or 7 minutes.
Right.
But it's indelible. Here's one of her scenes with William Holden. Another fantastic actor,
mm-hmm.
In a movie that has Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall and on,
right.
And on and on. Man, here's a scene from Network.
I'm your wife, damn it! And if you can't work up a winter passion for me, the least I require is respect and allegiance! Something for God's sake.
I've got nothing to say.
I won't give you up easily, Max. I think perhaps it is better if you move out. Does she love you, Max?
I'm not sure she's capable of any real feelings. She's television generation. She learned life from Bugs Bunny. The only reality she knows comes to her from over the TV set. She's very carefully devised a number of scenarios for all of us to play, like movie of the week. My God, look at us, Louise. Here we are going through the obligatory middle of act two, scorned wife throws peccant husband out scene. But don't worry, I'll come back to you in the end. All of her plot outlines have me leaving her and coming back to you because the audience won't buy a rejection of the happy American family. She does have one script in which I kill myself, an adapted for television version of Anna Karenina. Where she's Count Vronsky, and I'm Anna.
You're in for some dreadful grief, Max.
I know.
Yeah, it's an amazing scene.
That is.
It's an older man that's leaving his wife for this young, vibrant television programming executive played by Faye Dunaway. And he knows it's a crush. He knows it's destined to crash and burn.
He knows all too well.
Yeah, and it gives you sense too that scene. That's the most honest character in that piece, Beatrice Straight.
Mm-hmm, she is.
She's the one with no ulterior kind of motives. She's not in any part of any kind of corrupt system. She's like the one standing on the outside. Pure honesty.
That's right.
And it's so telling about William Holden in that scene where he thinks by being completely honest and straightforward that he's respecting her. But in a way, it's even more hurtful.
It is, yeah.
Because he says, are you in love with her? I don't know. I'm infatuated.
Mm-hmm.
He's honest,
yeah.
Yeah, and it just makes for more daggers in her heart. It's
mm-hmm.
such a powerful scene. We're going to interview an outstanding actor in just a few moments, and then we're going to play a little clip of some conversation we have with Kelly Masterson, the screenwriter of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which is Lumet's last movie that came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
A great, terrific, dirty, nasty piece of work.
That's one way of looking at it, yes.
Yeah, and then we're going to end up the show with another scene from probably my favorite Lumet film, which is Running on Empty, one of the most emotional scenes that I think he's ever directed.
Mm-hmm.
Network is one of them. Go out and rent it now if you haven't seen it or it's been a while since you've revisited it. That and Dog Day, remember what great movies were. It's amazing. Is there a movie that we haven't discussed that you wanted to bring up, Jerry?
Oh, no, but I will tell you this, though. I've been meaning to watch the last, you know, lately to watch Verdict again, and this has definitely been my cue to do that. Definitely, I can't wait to watch. It's been so, you'll have to forgive me, it's been many years since I've seen it, but that's the one I really want to see. There is one we haven't talked about, though, that I do like. I actually saw it in the theater when it came out, Q&A.
Yes.
I like that. I know a lot of people didn't like it. It was very controversial at the time because of the language and especially people accused it of being racist. But, you know, that's the film. Those are the people in the film. That's how they talk. I mean, it wasn't – no one was being racist, you know, definitely not Sidney Lumet. That's just the characters in the film.
It's that world of corruption that they live in, that code that they live by. And we're actually talking about Nick Nolte in the chat room. You know, the chat room, the discussion in there goes in all – different directions.
Yeah, I can't be in there. I have no internet. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're without internet tonight. But it's amazing Nick Nolte in that film because we're talking about Nick Nolte in the chat room and how, you know, when he's on. This is one of his great, largely unsung performances.
It is.
Go watch Q&A. He is a powerhouse of an actor. And actually, they accentuate. I was talking to Chris tonight about what they do with him in that movie. They accentuate his height and his kind of lumbering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's almost like the Frankenstein monster at times.
Yeah,
he's shot from behind. Ooh. Those big boots and to make him even more intimidating in that movie. Up against an actor like Timothy Hutton.
Timothy Hutton's very
also,
good.
Yeah,
Guzman is very good in that. And Armand Asante is excellent in that.
Armand Asante, you know, people talk about the Mambo Kings, but really discovered him big time from Q&A.
Yeah.
Lumet's use of Armand Asante in Q&A, just a great watershed performance that he gave. I think he was nominated for that one, actually. I'm not as sure about that, but as Jason O'Brien is. Jason's in our chat room. He's the Oscar guy, so maybe he can figure that out with it.
Wait, Jason? Of course, the one night I'm not in the chat room, Jason's in the chat room. Great. Hi, Jason.
Yeah. You're missing something with this chat room. It's
well,
very,
that's not my fault.
Nice.
There's tornadoes and thunderstorms came through the area and just wreaked havoc. So.
Yeah. That's bad. We get those seasons too. But it's been a very lively conversation. We've been talking about Gary Busey, Nick Nolte, and
oh, great, the two of them together. Oh my God!
That's a great. Hey, I would pay to see that pairing, man, in a second.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That's an unpredictable movie right there. They're saying that we should get an interview with them both at the same time on the show.
Video interview with Gary Busey for sure.
Yeah, that would be terrific. Q&A is right there with his other cop movies, Prince in the City,
and Serpico. It's like they're
Serpico.
Kind of viewed, and they were kind of viewed at the time as a trilogy before I guess Night Falls on Manhattan came out, but they're kind of viewed as like a cop trilogy, corrupt cop.
Yeah, Serpico probably is the clearest example of this theme of trying to exist unscathed in a corrupt world. Because obviously the story of Serpico, I mean, it's all about that. Another landmark Pacino performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great movie, and it lives right up there with Dog Day Afternoon.
It does.
And then Night Falls in Manhattan, you really get the sense that he's back where he belongs in the world where he belongs.
Yeah, he had a good year that year because he did that and Critical Care. Are about the I think the same year, if I'm not mistaken, 97, and he had a great year that year.
He really did. And talk about the cast of Night Falls in Manhattan: Ian Holm, Andy Garcia, James Gandolfini.
Yeah, everybody's in that movie.
Amazing. And our last guest tonight too, Night Falls in Manhattan. What a segue! I mean, we've timed this perfectly.
Yes, we have.
Thank you, Jerry. What a gift you've given. We are honored to welcome to the show tonight one of our greatest character actors, who's delivered a wealth of amazing performances in films as diverse as Face Off, City of Angels, Titus, The Insider, Sum of All Fears, Chicago, and The Chronicles of Riddick. He's worked with Mr. Lumet on two sensational pictures, Night Falls in Manhattan and Critical Care. His work on the stage is stunning, and encompasses some of theater's most enduring characters, like Hamlet, Romeo, Richard III, and Cyrano. And on the small screen, we've seen him shine in shows like Kung Fu, The West Wing, La Femme Nikita, Slings and Arrows, Battlestar Galactica, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and the upcoming season of 24. And don't think for a second that we're not going to ask about that. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome one of our favorite actors to the show, Mr. Colm Feore. Mr. Feore, are you with us?
I am indeed. Hello, guys. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Now tell me, I'm a huge fan of your work, and I have so much to ask you about, but I'll try to contain myself since this is limited to Lumet. What were you aware of Lumet's work before you started your collaboration with him? What were you taken by from his work?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we've all seen the Serpico's, the Dog Day Afternoons, the Verdicts. One of the things that was clear from just watching Sidney's films was that he loves actors. And yeah. Because he loves actors, he gets extraordinary performances from them. And when I had a chance to audition for him, first for Nightfalls on Manhattan, I leapt at it, and I got the blessing of my great aunt in New York City, Irish woman who'd lived there 50 years, and she dressed me up proper and sent me out, and she died just before I got in for the audition. And Sidney Lumet offered me the part in the room. And that never happens. I mean, it just simply never happens. And if it does, it's only happened to me once, and it was him. And so, consequently, I had to say to him, you know, it's my great aunt who's working on this right now, Sidney. But because he loves actors, because because he's been an actor, and he loves the whole process of acting, he is sympathetic, empathetic. He knows how to push actors to get more out of them than they knew they had, and he just relishes it. To sit and watch Sidney watching actors work, you know, sitting between two cameras that are both rolling on, you know, two people having a two-hander scene, it's just unbelievable.
Tell me what that does. I want to ask about his process and a lot of things that you've just brought up, but since you brought up the cameras, two cameras.
Well, Sidney's renowned for being a very, very fast and very, very prepared. I've known people who've gone on location scouts with him 6 months before he came to this remote location. He's gone to an open field and said, "We'll be here on a 50." And the 6 months later have arrived. They drive him to the set. He goes to the open field. Everything's changed. Snow has fallen. Spring has sprung. He goes, "We're here on a 50." And that kind of efficiency, I remember the first day, the first shot of Nightfalls on Manhattan, he had a 600-millimeter lens down the hall, I think at City Hall, and Ron Liebman was standing on a table giving some superlative acting, as only he can do, and Sidney Lumet, with all these, you know, 300 extras, everybody acting their heads off, first take, first shot, cut, print, move on. The stunned look on everybody's face, what do you mean, move on? And they all went, "Oh, my God, this guy's not kidding. We have to be ready. We have to be out of the trailers and acting right from the get-go because there is no looking back." And he set the tone instantly. And I asked him at some point, I said, "Sidney, what is the key to your vaunted speed?" And, you know, obviously he's written the book on how to make movies. He knows what he's doing. But he said, "Listen, on reflection, from a really good crew, my crew, I can get maybe 12 hours, you know, of concentrated work. From a good actor, if they're doing the job properly, 10 tops. Anything beyond that, I'm pushing my luck and I'm not getting anything. So it's just about knowing exactly what you want when you get in there, having actors who know what they want to do. At one point in the rehearsal, because keep in mind with Sidney, you don't just show up like you got the job on Friday, you show up Monday and you're acting. We did
right.
2 weeks of rehearsal. In the same
yeah.
rehearsal hall that Newman had used, that everybody, you know, it's at the Ukrainian Fires Hall downtown, and it was ridiculous because a bunch of us were staying at the Sherry Netherland. It was me, Ian Holm, and I was like starstruck like crazy, Richard Dreyfuss, and we all got down in the Sherry Netherland on the same elevator, and I had to say, "Hi, I'm Colm Feore, and you're Richard Dreyfuss, but but of course you know that. And it was just awkward and silly, and Ian Holm, I've just been a huge fan of forever, so I was really kind of mealy-mouthed, and I said, oh, we're going to go out, we're going to rehearsal. And I thought, we're going to go out, we jump in the van, and we go down. I go out, there's three town cars. We can't get in together. We all have to get into the separate town cars to drive to the, you know, Ukrainian or Hungarian Fireman's Hall downtown on 2nd Avenue and up to the, you know, the past the pissoir to the taped-out rehearsal hall floor. And James Gandolfini is there, and everybody's, you know, ready to go. Andy Garcia walks to the corner of the room, and he looks out over this tape mark on the floor and says, Sidney, I'd like to, you know, take this character and take this moment and walk over here and look out this window. And Sidney says, it's a great idea. I didn't build that wall. Think of something else. And that was it. And so Andy went, oh, okay, I'll turn that around in the rest of the room and we'll shoot that.
Wow. I'm fascinated by this rehearsal process, and we actually asked Chris Sarandon earlier in the show about it. You know, all actors need different things, I would think. What do you need as an actor, and what did Lumet give that to you?
Well, one of the things that he did was he really embraced all the actors and all the different acting styles. Keep in mind, around our table on the first day, Lena Olin, and I mean, I don't think it's too much to say, she was nursing and Lasse Hallström was hiding in a back room. It was too delicious for words. But you had Lena Olin, Andy Garcia, Ian Holm, Ron Liebman, James Gandolfini, Richard Dreyfuss. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was truly ridiculous. Yeah. And we had Sidney's daughter, who was playing one of the young romantic interests. I mean, it was unbelievable. And what he said, it was so generous. He looked around the table and he said, look, everybody here, almost every one of you to a man or woman, has a different acting style, has come at this from a different way. We're going to embrace all of that. We're going to allow everybody their way to find their way, but we got to make a family. And this is how we're going to do it. And so that was the first step, and it was so generous and so, you know, so welcoming that everybody just thought, fine. So Andy's, you know, Cuban but Irish, but of, you know, and Ian Holm, who's English, is Irish, and Lena is going to be, you know, and everybody just simply went, fine, Ron Liebman, I got it, and you know, give me a cheesy hairpiece, I understand what's going on. I will say something funny, because we did a take, me and Andy were doing there's the debate scene where we're going for DA, and we've got like 300 extras again, and we do the whole thing. And again, after the first take, he shouts, cut, print, move on. And he goes, no, what do you, listen, it takes me at least, you know, 17, you know, seven takes to warm up. I like to do maybe 17. I like to do this. I like to do that. And Sidney, you know, he said, I got it. I said, you know, it's a wide lens, a long lens. I'm back. I know what I want. This is just this little piece, and we're going to move in. But Andy really wanted to get it right. And right. So after much humming and hawing, Sidney said, all right, we'll go again for Andy. But keep in mind, I got to watch all this boring shit. and Garcia went, okay, I get it. But Ron Liebman would go, Sidney, it's not right now. Boom. And he actually broke his hand pounding the desk one day. He actually went that far. But he would get a third, maybe a fourth, even maybe a fifth take. Finally, Garcia says, so what, you got to be Jewish and from New York to get a third take on this picture? And at that point, Sidney actually went, okay, Andy, one more for you, just for free. Go ahead.
I want to ask you about Ron Liebman, because he is a powerhouse in this movie. He owns the space that he's given. And he's really in your face a couple of scenes. What is that? What is that like?
I have to say, I was a little younger then too. I was intimidated by Ron. He's such a generous and wonderfully supportive guy. He, you know, the first thing he said to me was he was a huge fan of a little Canadian film called 32 Short Films about Glenn Gould, and he'd seen it. He'd actually seen it, you know. So that made him rare among, you know, my parents and then Ron. So you know, I was disarmed, and then he started acting, and of course I was blown away. But he was very generous. I mean, we all knew it was acting, you know, so you embrace it, you stand for it, and you say, listen, whatever you want to bring, I'll try and be there. And you know, I just was a little worried my bow tie would be crooked. Yeah. Oh, because the way he was, you know, he'd scream at me.
Yeah, just the sound waves alone would.
Yeah.
Let me get your take on this. The rehearsal process, I'm sure it's a great luxury. Is there still moments of discovery when you're actually doing it on the set?
Absolutely. There's nothing to discuss because there's a spontaneity. I mean, I just had the great pleasure of and privilege of working on a Clint Eastwood picture. I did The Changeling.
Yes.
And I said, you know, listen, he's a lot like Sidney. And, you know, it's three takes. We shoot the rehearsal. We move on. I never actually got lunch on the picture because we were always wrapped before we got to it.
And beautiful.
It's extraordinary. But again, it's guys who know what they want, who, and as Eastwood said, I don't want to rob you of the spontaneity of the first time you do it. So if you can shoot the rehearsal, shoot the rehearsal. Because you're ready. Listen, you auditioned. You already know the lines. So bring your best in, first out. Because after 3, 4, 5, you're going to get tired. Something's going to be lost in translation here.
Right.
And that is precisely what happened with Sidney. You'd have worked it out, and you could say to him, where there wasn't a crew standing by, there were no producers looking over people's shoulders, look, Sidney, what do you think if I do this? He'd go, you know what? No, not so much. I didn't build that wall. There is no window there. Or I don't think the character would do that. And it's not costing anybody anything. And it's a creative process so that when you show up on the set on the day that, you know, your scene is actually booked, you know exactly what's going on. And if we need to adjust, everybody's so ready and his team of people are so familiar with his style that if you want to change something on the fly, everybody's willing to go for it. So you capture magical, spontaneous moments just because you were all ready.
Yeah, and
does that make any sense?
Makes perfect
sense.
Oh, yeah. You are fantastic. You're answering 20 of my questions, and I've only asked one or two. So.
Sorry, that is a problem I have.
It's infectious. Thank God for it. You've been on many sets. So how do those differ from a Lumet set? I mean, would a Lumet set spoil you if you know?
Yeah, and you know, listen, I have to say I am very blessed, and I worked for Sidney very early on in my film career. I had a big theater career, something that Sidney understood and appreciated, and you know. That's part of the thing, you know, preparation, because you're live. Well, you know, listen, you're live in front of 100 crew, and you're live in front of the director who sits there on a stool watching every moment and appreciating every moment and looking for these new discoveries as well as the things that the seeds that he's already planted. And so his sets are glorious, not to mention the fact that they're really quick. He would do 2-unit moves on the streets of New York and be out by 2:45 on a Friday afternoon. You'd beat the traffic. And maybe it's because he wanted to get to his place in Connecticut. Maybe. I don't know. The fact of the matter was he got what he needed, and he never – I did ask him again. I said, listen, Sidney, is there nothing that would make you do another take? He said, if it's a technical flaw but the acting is perfect, I won't go back. If there's something and a sound man says, I would like a little better sound, he said, I know really good guys with razors who are experts in their field who will do the best sound reconstruction. I'm fine with that. Because if the performance is there, the rest will follow. And
well, it's obvious that it's not a compromise from watching his work. There's
no
weak performance in a Lumet film.
And he is brutally honest. He is nothing if not honest. He lets nothing pass. So, you know, if you think, oh, I might be able to get away with this, he won't have noticed this, he'll stop and go, that's not quite, no, sorry, no. Just no.
Wow.
And because you've done so much work in the rehearsal, you start in the ballpark. It's not like you have to get to take 27 before you're anywhere close to what he wants. He saw what he wanted in the audition. He saw more of what he wanted, hopefully, and refined it in the rehearsals. When you show up and it's actually costing real production dollars, and of course, the fact of the matter was, we were so good, we were so fast. And keep in mind, we had a big cast, lots of locations, he was all over town. He still finished a week and a half early. The producers were begging him, go to Central Park, shoot some taxis. It looks like we asked for too much money. Just shoot, you know, idle life, wandering by. He says, no, thanks, I'm going to the country, I'm done. And they tore their hair out because they knew he'd be a week and a half early and $2 or $3 million under budget, and they'd look like they were greedy, you know. But it was—I mean, I was fascinated by the whole process. I mean, I'm a photographer in the hobby life because it helps, you know, figure out how to be, you know, more able to serve the process on a film set. And I said, well, now, Sidney, it's not as simple as simply rehearsing. He said, well, I asked the cinematographer, and both occasions I worked for him, we had the extraordinary David Watkins. And also known as Wendy Watkins in the trade. And he would say, listen, I speak to the cinematographer. He said, if I shoot this direction now, what's going to happen to the sunshine and you and your lights? Well, governor, as David Watkins would say, if you do that to me, it'll take me 3 hours after lunch to relight this. Very well, then, what we'll do is we'll block shoot the whole day's work from this side of the table. Which means, I mean, there's a scene in Critical Care where, you know, a bunch of lawyers meet and Kira Sedgwick is doing one thing or another. I forget exactly how it went, but table shots are terribly difficult to do. And if you were to shoot all of the actors, I think Ed Herman, myself, and Kathy Bates, and a whole bunch of people on one side of the table, then we have to do all our day's acting in the morning. Because then we're going to switch the lights over and do everybody else's acting on the other side. That requires people who know what they're doing. In the finished film, you'll never know the difference. But it meant we saved 3.5 hours of people sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
He's amazing, amazing craftsman, mm-hmm. he is.
But it's really, I mean, the real focus on craft and preparation allows you remarkable freedom in the execution. Because, of course, you've actually bought yourself the time to go, you know what? Take a steady cam and just wander over there. I remember doing The Insider. Michael Mann had 2 or 3 cameras set up. We were acting our heads off. It was all great. He saw something else he wanted. He raised his arm. He clicked his fingers, and he said, and, you know, his guys knew what that meant. They threw a camera on his shoulders, and some of the stuff spinning around Al is Michael. I need another camera. There's something I see I can get here. And everybody played ball. Cinematographer went fine. I mean, Tom Stern on the Eastwood thing, Eastwood doesn't say cut. He barely says, okay, that's enough. So if he doesn't say cut, people keep acting. But, of course, he hasn't lit the whole thing. So, you know, trying to catch Angelina Jolie with a great big reflector, and the cinematographer himself is carrying it around. The Steadicam operator is moving with it. I see where the camera's going. I know what the lens is. I know what they're working on. I say, I can participate in this. Obviously, he loves what's going on. Carry on. We just keep going.
You know,
it's really exciting.
I have to tell you, this conversation is a dream for me because I was going to ask you about The Insider and Michael Mann, and then talking about Lumet, and these are films that, you know, Jerry and I both lived with.
Yeah,
for
you're
for
just
so
going,
long.
You're delivering the goods.
Oh, I'm glad.
You're making me such a happy movie geek right now.
I'm so glad.
There is something though thematically that's very similar in some of Lumet's films, and we've spoken about it earlier in the show how you try to come out unscathed in kind of a morally corrupt environment. And, you know, Nightfall's law enforcement, critical care, health care. Was there any discussion of a theme around the table, or was it just creating the moments as an actor?
Well, no, obviously. I mean, and the body of his work in Prince of the City and all of that stuff, and, you know, Serpico, it's something that has kept him busy and interested for pretty much his whole career. But decency, morality, you know, human beings trying in a difficult situation and circumstances to do the right thing. Obviously, those of us who signed on knew we were looking at those kind of stories. So he didn't have to beat us over the head with that.
Right, right. And the fact that he's now...
And Sheikh Mahmoud Bey, who was just staggering in it. You know,
yeah.
And listen, keep in mind, there was a wonderful moment where we were rehearsing down on 2nd Avenue, and Sheikh was giving this remarkable performance, and just he was busting out all over, and it was a little bit frightening. And we heard this extraordinary noise on the street. And people said, come on back, because I don't know if Lena was nursing in the back room, looked over the street, and our rehearsal was a little further away. There was a celebration going on the street. It was the day O.J. was acquitted, and the streets were going mental.
Mm.
And, of course, this cloud just came over the room. Dreyfus, who's of course very political and very, you know, and had been Dreyfus was, I think, if memory serves, he was a guest of Judge Ito's on one of those days. It was just, it was just, you know, life imitating art, imitating life, imitating mm-hmm. art, and suddenly we thought, this has value, this has relevance, this is difficult. Mm.
And he'll use that too. I mean, he savors those accidents and that spontaneity. I've heard in a big way. Tell me about your thoughts on his longevity. I mean, this is unprecedented. He's 83 years old. He's just directed one of the great movies of his career, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. What do you attribute that to?
You know what? He leads a healthy life, I'm sure, and he loves the work, and he's You know, I think to a degree he's pure of heart and spirit. He knows what he's fighting for, and I think he knows what he's living for, and mm-hmm. he doesn't seem to have ever taken a wrong step in terms of doing what it is that moves him and what he wants to do, what he feels is correct to do. You know, there was 100 Center Street, which was a big undertaking because, of course, it was television and meant being there all the time.
Right.
And that, you know, so I think that stuff keeps him alive. I bumped into him. I was doing a play on Broadway not too long ago with Denzel Washington. We were doing a Julius Caesar there in the summer of 05, and I was living on the Upper West Side, and, of course, that's where he lives. And I was walking down the street, and there was Sidney. And I thought, oh, he won't remember me. I said, Mr. Lumet. He said, yes, of course, I remember you. I said, you hired me a couple of times. I played lawyers. What a surprise. But, you know, I just wanted to thank him for being, you know, kind enough to, you know, hire me, to believe in me, to just, you know, be there for me. And he looked exactly the same as he had whenever it was I'd seen him last, which was, you know, a dozen years before. You know, so clearly it's good living and hard work.
Right.
Yeah, well, we adore him on the show. That's why we wanted to do the show, and to, in our own way, to thank him for so many years of such great films and performances. I cannot let you go. Anyone that knows anything about me knows that I have a major a thing for Al Pacino. He's an idol for me. And Michael Mann, too. Talk about a fantastic filmmaker. Did you have any – I know there were phone conversations in the film. Did you have any – scenes with Pacino or any moments?
Oh yeah, we were acting together. We did our acting together down at I've just talked to the Wall Street Journal not too long ago, just before Dickie Scruggs was indicted for trying to bribe a judge for $50,000. I don't know if you read the New York Times recently or the New Yorker.
I read that article. I got a thing,
you know, a call from the blog guy from the Wall Street Journal said, you know, I want you to answer some questions, and we've asked John Grisham, and we've done, what about Dickie Scruggs? What about this? I said, that's way too dumb for Dickie. Never going to happen. And you know, minutes later, he's taken the fall. I think this cannot be.
Mm.
But you know, we were down there at Dickie's house in Pascagoula, which has since, you know, Katrina, been wiped out, and he's moved on now to the old Mrs. town, what is it, the university town.
Mm-hmm.
But we used his house. He actually auditioned for my part, and he didn't get it. But Michael didn't tell him until he picked up the tab. But he was still very gracious. He let us use the house, and Al and I and Russell, we rehearsed actually in Kentucky at the hotel there in Louisville. And we had a wonderful dinner with Michael and Chris Plummer and Al and company and Al Capone's favorite, the Oak Room Lounge, Al Capone's favorite dining room at the Sealback Hotel. And Al was terrific. I mean, the thing that Al did that was so delightfully disarming was that he was very, you know, he was very relaxed and cool about the whole thing. We're sitting in Dickie Scruggs's mansion in Pascagoula. They got the director's chair set up. Russell's around. Jeffrey Wigand was around. Lowell Bergman was around. I mean, the real guys and the fake guys were all there together. We had a huge, big crowd scene. A guy comes in, kicks open the fridge, grabs a Diet Coke, says, "How are y'all doing?" And it's Trent Lott because he's Dickie's brother-in-law. And, you know, it went absolutely mental from there on in. Some of the actors gave him a hard time for some of the stuff he'd done in the Senate just at the time. But Al was asked, "Listen, Mrs. Scruggs, the elder, Dickie's mom, would like to meet you." And he said, that'd be fine. So he's sitting in the director's chair in the front hall, and she's got a little old friend with her, and they come up and they introduce to Al, and they say, "Mr. Pacino, it's a pleasure to meet you," and blah, 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 isn't that nice? And before they can step out of earshot, the second old woman says, I thought he'd be taller. And Al says, "I thought so too." And it was so agreeable, so charming, so very relaxed and easy. You just thought he could have left the room. They could have all taken their private planes and gone away, but no. And so he let Bruce McGill take a round or two out of Trent Lott on the nature of homosexuals and who should be accepted and who shouldn't, and on we went. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean,
man,
also I think it's one of the finest performances that Russell's ever given. I mean, he was acting his head off in the very best way. In fact, there were moments where Michael had to actually just say, "We've run out of film. Stop talking. Stop.
Wow.
Cut. And we're gone." Because he had this tobacco thing so down. He put on all the weight. He was so into the character. And, you know there were girls named Tammy bleeding from the thighs chasing him out of every town he'd been through. It was not pretty, but he was so good.
And that is a movie that will live on forever, like many, many, many of Lumet's films. And 24. Can you tell us anything about 24?
Well, I'm
top,
very happily.
Top
I mean, it's me and Cherry Jones. Cherry Jones is the president of the United States, and I guess I'd be the Bill Clinton in the back rooms, getting up to no good. And the rest of the 24 machine percolates on, around the White House and beyond us. It's the nicest people in the world to work for. I've had such a good time. We got a little bit bumped by the writer's strike, but we're back at it now. The whole thing will run January of 2009.
Okay.
But
okay.
We're going to do a prequel to the number 7 season, which we're shooting now concurrently with the season, which will come out in the fall. And hopefully
– like a two-hour movie? Or
yeah, what? And it will give a little bit of a preamble to to season 7, which I think is brilliant on their part. It'll hopefully whet people's appetite and keep them interested, but also it'll add, details to what is, obviously a very complex story.
Okay, good.
Right.
That's good. All right.
Well, Colin, we love you, man.
It's very heartening. I'm calling you now from a payphone in Banff, Alberta, where I am the chair of the international jury at the World Television Festival. So I'm spending my days and nights. I said, I can't work the June the 4th. I'm talking to the geeks. So you've got to book me off. I can't. No more documentaries. No more entertainment programs from the BBC. I've got to go. And I got a great group of people here. We're watching some fabulous stuff. But I was determined to be free to talk to you guys, so I'm so glad.
This has been absolute heaven for us. And please come back anytime you'd like.
I'd be delighted.
Any of these future projects.
You know
thank
where
you
to
so
find
much,
me.
Colin.
Thank you guys.
So much.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Oh, I think that's the best guest we've ever had on the show.
I have to agree. That was wonderful.
Oh, what a great talent. What a great guy. That's Colin Fior. You heard him, folks. I don't know. We've probably left the live feed. Jerry, you with me?
Yeah, I'm here. Well, I'd like to add something, though, because of something he said.
Yeah, I've lost all of my sound files, so the show is probably, officially over because I've lost all my sound files, but go ahead, Ned.
All right. It's really interesting. He was talking about working with Eastwood, and I would have to say that of directors alive, Eastwood would be the only director I could even think to compare him to because of the longevity, who Lumet really reminds me of, and Eastwood also, is John Huston. Worked all the way through. I don't even, if it was possible, I don't even think he'd let death get in the way, John Huston, but they worked, and it was consistently good, especially the last couple films Huston did, Under the Volcano, Prizzi's Honor, The Dead, and the same thing with Lumet. Everything is just gold.
Yeah, it is. And we've run short of time. What I'm going to do, I'm going to play, just in case this last the archive recording lasts longer than the live recording, I'm going to go ahead and play our interview snippet from Kelly Masterson for the replay listeners. The vast majority of our listeners are replay. And then I'm going to play the last scene from Running on Empty, and hopefully the replay will capture it all. But, Jerry, thank you so much, buddy. Another great show.
You. It was a wonderful time.
And if you're up in 20 minutes, give me a call. I won't talk to you.
All right. Good night. Good night.
All right, buddy.
Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're going to close off the show. I'm going to put my phone up to my speaker, and I'm going to play this interview with Kelly Masterson since my switchboard went out. We're just going to improvise here for the archive listeners. Here's a little snippet from our interview with him. First-time screenwriter, longer-time playwright, whose first screenplay was picked up by Lumet and made into Before the Devil Knows You're Dead with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke and Albert Finney, the last great Lumet film released last year. Here's that interview.
Now, Lumet has said that this is a melodrama, in that the story itself defines the characters. Do you agree with that?
To a certain extent, and certainly the way Mr. Lumet explains melodrama, it certainly works with this script. You know, my idea of melodrama has always been the villain and, you know, the heroine tied to the train track. So when I hear melodrama, I don't necessarily think of this piece.
Right.
But the way he talks about events shaping which directions the characters go, once the story starts rolling along, these characters are just sucked in, and they roll along, and they react. It's not a proactive sort of decision-making process on their part. So from that point of view, and in Mr. Lumet's definition of a melodrama, it is that.
Mm. So how did you get your script into the hands of Lumet?
Well, I've heard three different stories.
So tell us yours.
Let me tell you the one I like the most.
Okay. All right.
I don't really know which is true. Brian Lindsay, who is one of the producers, he and Michael Sorenzi had actually optioned it from me and worked on it for a few years before Mr. Lumet got involved, had attached a different director to it who then fell out of the project. And they had some financing in place, and they were looking to quickly attach a new director to it, and they were looking for names. They wanted to get a list of names from Peter Berg at ICM. Peter Berg is Sidney Lumet's agent and also runs ICM. So what they really wanted was a list of available directors. They figured the best way to ask Mr. Berg that was to call him up and say, we'd like to offer it to Sidney Lumet. And then when Sidney turned it down, then they would say, well, since Sidney isn't available, who is? But what happened was Mr. Berg got the script to Mr. Lumet, and Mr. Lumet called Brian Lindsay and Michael Sorenzi within a week and said he wanted to do it.
Ah, what a dream.
Yeah, what a dream. Isn't that amazing?
And he's 83 years old.
He's made
some of the great classic films of all time, and they say that he is just, after viewing this film, he is just as energetic and vital as he's ever been, which is amazing.
Absolutely. Can you imagine what a ride it is for a first-time screenwriter to get someone as legendary and as brilliant as Mr. Lumet to do?
I can't imagine. And especially someone who, you know, I get the sense from him that he has real respect for the writing. But it's very surprising to me. I think I read that he let it slip in an interview last week that he's never actually met you.
Jamie, did you have to bring that up? Yeah, he did. He did say that, and I have been in contact with him. And we did meet. We met on the set.
Oh.
I guess I'm not all that memorable, but luckily my script is memorable, and he devoted himself, you know, heart and soul to bringing that to life. The only thing I can I can say to explain that is that what he has told me is that he suffers from tunnel vision, and he is so devoted to getting the work out of the actors and getting the work in the can that everything else is peripheral.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to be peripheral in his process because of what, you know, the end product of what he's put up there on the screen.
Okay, those are clips from Kelly Masterson, the screenwriter of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, speaking about his collaboration with Lumet. That's about all the time we have. I think we've gone over time. Hopefully this hasn't been cut off, but it's been a privilege to bring you this tribute show. Hope everyone enjoyed it out there. Please join us again on Sunday, this Sunday, June 8th, for an exclusive interview with Chris Lemon, who's just written a book about his father, Jack, and Shane O'Sullivan, the director of a new documentary called RFK Must Die. It's going to be a fantastic show on Sunday night. Please join us. And thanks for joining us tonight. Good night, everyone.